and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to this special series on my PhD thesis. Last time we looked at insults and how they could be used by political opponents and newspapers to apply pressure on the government. We also saw Anglo-Russian relations deteriorate as the Treaty of Unkiar-Skelessi established Russian influence in Constantinople and affirmed access to the Black Sea. The Tsar was appearing increasingly expansionist and opportunistic, qualities which were admirable in a colonial British official, but intolerable in a Europe where so much was at stake. A running theme, as you'll see, is that the British tended to present themselves as exceptional and the exception to the rule that European states should refrain from seeking ways to increase their power. They also saw themselves as legitimate in responding to insult however they pleased, while the French were somehow emotional and overly sensitive. Here we see the temporary resolution of the Eastern question and the first major triumph of Palmerston's career. When the negotiations over the fate of the Ottoman Empire led to the exclusion of France from the settlement and Paris cried foul, Palmerston warned against compromise and believed that the French intended to use Egypt to assert its influence in the Near East. This was intolerable, and while Palmerston urged his colleagues to remain firm, he also managed to reduce Russian aims, erasing the Treaty of Unkiar-Skelessi and returning Russo-Turkish relations to a more level playing field. The Tsars of the future might seek to undermine this settlement, but Palmerston could emphasize these victories and use them as evidence in his case that he and he alone had managed to protect the national interest and uphold the national honor. Remarkably, this approach had the effect of replacing the Russian boogeyman with that of Paris, and a new Anglo-French war threatened during the summer and autumn of 1840. The Foreign Secretary would be defined by how he responded to this crisis. It was thus the beginning of Palmerston's legend, as much as the beginning of a new epoch in British foreign policy. Henceforth, Russia would be viewed with suspicion, and certain segments of British opinion came to see the Tsar as the greatest threat to Britain's position. Palmerston was not set either way. He maintained British honour did not require war, but he also established a reputation for readiness for such a war in the event it was required. After the shaky start we examined in the last episode, this was precisely the antidote the government required to reassert its claim to power, no matter what the Tories might say. But the creeping shadow of political change was a battle Palmerston had less success with. He could not control these tides, even if he could manage their effects. Besides, after 11 years in power, had he not earned something of a break? This break would come, but in this episode, we'll see both the beginning of Palmerston's legend and a clear demonstration of how the rhetoric of national honour could swing opinions and policy in another direction. Furthermore, such PR campaigns enabled ministerial defence and undermined the accusations made by political opponents while presenting the Whigs as the true defenders of national honour. Did they deserve this mantle? Let's investigate as I take you to the final part of my thesis's first chapter, where we start by considering how contemporaries could diffuse the tensions when insults came at inconvenient moments. Chapter 1, Part 3, Insult and Satisfaction, The Origins of the Eastern Question, Continued. When a minor incident concerning the displays of flags occurred off Mauritius in September 1839, causing furor in the Tomps, which called for Frenchmen to acquire a speedy vindication of national honour, the Newcastle Courant warned that the good understanding that exists between the cool-headed members of either cabinet will not be affected by the indiscretions or the over-punctiliousness of subordinate naval officers. The Morning Chronicle added that it would not imitate the Tomps in calling on our ministry to be very defying and very spirited in its remonstrances on this subject, because each government is sufficiently tied down to support national interest and national honour. It discerned some obstinacy and mistakes on either side, and pledged itself to not write a word which might awaken animosity between brave men. Despite the zeal for vindication, then, ministers simply could not afford to treat every insult equally. It might be argued that where the improper respect of flags could be navigated, the forcible naval boarding or mistreatment of a British subject demanded a response. This latter species of insult, indeed, characterised the Trent affair. Where national honour was insulted, either by improper respect shown to flags or by the mistreatment of individuals under British protection, national excitement was liable to be fanned by opposition figures and newspapers. This furore could be leveraged against the government and would require an explanation. It was also common to connect the possession of power with the maintenance of honour, while the absence of it would imperil British prestige and influence and invite those insults from opportunistic rivals. This was a lesson inherited from the Napoleonic Wars, and Viscount Sandon, a Tory MP and political veteran of that era, could thus argue that if they had really sent a British force within the contested waters of the River La Plata or the Gulf of Mexico, then she would have defended her financial interests there, and above all, the honour of the British flag would not have been exposed to the insult it had recently received. The Whigs could never publicly admit that their distribution of force had been insufficient to defend national honour, but Palmerston did privately advocate for a strong naval presence to legitimise British policy. Though it was damaging to improperly defend British honour through such mismanagement, it would be shameful and potentially ruinous to engage with empty threats, a lesson Palmerston forgot to his detriment when grappling with the Schleswig-Holstein crisis. As honour-based rhetoric was invoked to affect foreign policy, it may be of use to consider how Melbourne's administration reacted to French deployment of this language to apply pressure on Britain. After a truce of several years, Egyptian Viceroy Mehmed Ali Pasha renewed his war in 1839, seizing more territory in the Levant and inflicting humiliating defeats upon the Sultan within the year. Since Anglo-Russian relations remained tense, Palmerston turned to France, and he reflected privately that it was impossible for London and Paris to have remained passive spectators in the partition of the Ottoman Empire without causing discredit to the governments of England and France. He had added that empowering the Sultan was akin to a British national interest, and he warned Henry Bulwer, then serving as embassy secretary in Constantinople, that to establish Mehmed Ali Pasha in Syria would be to build on sand. The quest to assert influence in the Ottoman Empire, the importance of playing a part in its future, and the connection of these ideas with British prestige was a struggle which compelled Benjamin Disraeli to intervene with even greater force 40 years later. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire appeared imminent, and Palmerston responded to the chaotic circumstances by signing a collective note with the Five Powers in late July 1839. The agreement committed Britain, France, Austria, Russia, and Prussia to maintain and defend the Sultan from further aggression and to coerce Egypt to compromise. Yet, the powers were not on the same page. France, particularly, seemed hesitant to abandon Mehmed Ali Pasha, who the French people had identified as a sort of Oriental Bonaparte, while the potential advantages of a French-aligned Egypt pulled French opinion further from their erstwhile allies. In September 1839, Palmerston warned Henry Bulwer, now ambassador to France, of his fear that France would employ force to prevent us and those powers who may join us from doing that which France herself is bound by every principle of honour and very enlightened consideration of her interests to assist us in doing. Later in the month, it was evident to him that France have wishes and objects at bottom which they are ashamed of confessing, that no French interest could be promoted by supporting Mehmed Ali, and that the character of France as a country which adheres to her word would thereby be greatly affected. This correspondence underlines the belief in the importance of good faith and the fulfilment of obligations, and suggests that similar sentiments expressed in public were not merely for show. Just as British good faith had been at stake in continuing the Russian-Dutch loan, French good faith was concerned in her obligation to the collective note. However, in March 1840, a more reactionary French government under Adolphe Thiers assumed power, and support for Egypt became a key facet of French policy. By the summer, the Sultan's prospects had not improved, and it was clear foreign intervention was required if peace was to be restored. Palmerston had told Lord Melbourne that "the honour and dignity of the country, good faith towards the Sultan, and sound views of European policy all recommended British support for Turkish integrity." However, with French support for Mehmed Ali affirmed, it was necessary to reconstitute a treaty on the Ottoman Empire's future without French support, and this was accomplished in mid-July 1840. The terms of this treaty had been anticipated by Palmerston's conversations with the Russian ambassador, and in a Commons session, Palmerston prepared members for this reconciliation by asserting that "it was impossible for any government to have acted with more honour and good faith in any manner than the Russian government had acted with the other powers in respect to Turkey." It was plain that French support for Mehmed Ali placed the Entente in jeopardy. Palmerston believed French belligerence was to blame, and warned a colleague that "incidents might at any time happen that might bring on a quarrel upon some point of honour." Palmerston could have pointed to the damage done to French good faith by Thiers's abandonment of previous obligations, yet he kept details of the settlement hidden even after it had been concluded in July 1840. French exclusion from the settlement was guaranteed to cause alarm, as the divisions within cabinet revealed. Contemporaries discerned that in these circumstances, "one of two opinions should be held by the French people, either that the Grand Nation had been grossly insulted by the Grand Nation's neighbours, or that the national honour had been compromised by Monsieur Thiers through what may be esteemed a gross and unstatesmanlike blunder." Thiers was himself forced to choose between an unwinnable war or a disastrous climb down, and King Louis-Philippe effectively chose for him when Thiers's government was dismissed in September 1840. This change in government did not resolve the crisis, and reflecting on the mood in Paris, the Times warned that "a sentiment pervades the entire population of Paris that the national honour has been insulted," adding a few days later that "every brawler is sensitive about the national honour, too often in the ratio of his callousness about his own." A contributor urged the Whigs to preserve the Entente with France, asking, "in what, then, does our national honour consist if not in the maintenance of what is most honourable to our nation?" Although an Anglo-French war scare had intensified during the summer and autumn of 1840, Palmerston's determination to hold his nerve and his willingness to cooperate with the Holy Alliance proved the difference. The Morning Post asked whether French national honour might have been maintained at a cheaper rate than the 20 millions that had been wasted on needless war preparations. Others interpreted Thiers's bluster as a search for domestic popularity, because "speeches in which the national honour and nation's glory form prominent features are always favourable for displays of eloquence." Due to Palmerston's efforts to delay discussion, Parliament hosted only a single debate on the ongoing controversy in early August. Therein, the radical MP with Chartist sympathies, John Leader, considered that among French papers, "there appeared to be a general feeling of bitterness and disappointment, and a belief that their honour had been insulted, and that in these proceedings, Palmerston had sacrificed them to the other great powers of Europe." The French cried foul at their exclusion, connecting it with their honour, and John Leader reflected that while "he might be told that this was a mere matter of form in the negotiations, unfortunately, the French were very nice and touchy on points of honour in matter of this kind, though, certainly, they could not be blamed for having a nice sense of honour, and there was, in addition to this, a feeling that this country wished to act against them or overreach them in this matter," which John Leader disputed. Of course, the French response was not unique. A consideration of Disraeli's behaviour several years later, when Britain was not consulted in the 1878 Treaty of San Stefano, suggests that French statesmen behaved little differently from their British counterparts when they felt excluded from pivotal negotiations. Indeed, as John Russell confessed in September 1840, "If England were the party omitted, I do not think we should be satisfied with such professions," as Britain and Russia had given to Paris. The Morning Post also highlighted French sensitivity to any perceived slight, yet it blamed Thiers above all, since he raised the cry of wounded national honour and set his old engine, the press, at work to excite the people. It was nonetheless fortunate that although Thiers put the match to the train with the eagerness of a madman, it still reflects great credit on the thinking part of the nation that they should, generally speaking, have shown so much more sanity than their leaders. The French people were being manipulated for the gain of the government, but sensitivity to the national honour was far from a uniquely French trait, as the Morning Herald articulated. "When the national honour or other interests are at issue, a warlike policy may be consistent with the most rigid prudence, because, for all possible accidents, dishonour is the most costly that may befall a great people." The Times also recognised the anguish of the French reaction, noting that it was felt by all the enlightened, by nearly all the civilised world, that no consideration of merely a prudential nature could lead any humanised people to meet an insult by direct hostility, except a moral certainty that the national honour, if left unvindicated by a single instance, would be offended and trampled on afterwards in many others from the confidence of impunity that aggressors might be encouraged to entertain. Self-defence, the Times believed, was the only justifiable cause of hostilities. There had been no aggression against France, and Palmerston had made efforts to include Paris in the final settlement, yet the French press had still roused the people into a frenzy, directed primarily against London and Palmerston in particular. The Morning Herald even commended the forbearance of the London press in refusing to take this bait, particularly while Paris was under impressions, believed here to be erroneous, of national honour insulted, because France was still entitled to respect. Although this forbearance among the press was praised, Palmerston's own speeches have tended not to the vindication of national honour, not to national advantage, oh no, but to stop the panic and the fall of prices, and to restore the spirits of the stock jobbers and raise the process of the funds. Having insulted France, unintentionally or not, Palmerston could then be criticised for attempting to mollify the insult's severity, even while it was recognised that England, on every reason of honour and policy, is bound to maintain the integrity of the Turkish Empire. High Tory papers were reluctant to concede him a triumph. Although the moment was opportune for leveraging his strategic advantages against France, Palmerston rejected belligerency and remained hopeful of a peaceful outcome while urging his peers to use firm and stout language. The successful naval campaign against Mehmed Ali's forces in Syria granted military weight to British policy, which had been lacking, and it was largely lauded as proof of the country's continued supremacy at sea. Palmerston's pursuit of Turkish sovereignty and his flexibility in cooperating with adversaries in the name of this goal facilitated his triumph, which Charles Webster regarded as perhaps the greatest which he ever won in his long connection with foreign affairs. Of additional note were Russian concessions. The controversial 1833 Treaty of Unkiar-Skelessi had been replaced by a more moderate settlement which granted Russia no exclusive privileges. The Times reflected that nothing is wanting to convert this success into an honourable triumph, but to make a wise and moderate use of it. Conclusion. The Whig stewardship of British foreign policy between 1830 and 1841 provides a useful introduction to the rhetoric of honour and how it was used by ministers and opposition figures in Parliament and the press. What emerges is the prevalence of the lexicon of honour, and it may be suggested existing surveys of the period have missed important nuances in contemporary belief and rhetoric by failing to interrogate the ethic. Such interrogations would face challenges posed by National Honor's varied application to a wide range of concerns. National Honor could be maintained by adhering to obligations, while reneging on them would constitute a violation which would be publicly lamented. Concepts such as good faith were considered precious enough to pursue, even if it meant incurring greater expenses or combating various interpretations of the law, as the Russian-Dutch loan debates suggest. Incurring insults from foreign powers, either through apparently trivial incidents concerning improper treatment of flags, or weightier controversies involving mistreatment of protected citizens, would always demand satisfaction, or at the very least explanation, in a public space. The Portuguese case suggests that other nations possessed a similar regard for the ethic, to the extent that it was considered dishonourable to prevent them from vindicating it, no matter the target. Importantly, it was possible to connect British interests with national honour, facilitating Palmerston's preservation of the Ottoman Empire's integrity, accompanied by efforts to enact meaningful reform. When France declared itself insulted by its exclusion, Francophile critics did not persuade Palmerston to change course, though he was careful not to exacerbate the crisis. This was insufficient for his critics, who charged him with favouring economic interests even when the national honour was upheld. Palmerston resisted calls within cabinet for greater concessions to France, and even offered his resignation, which Melbourne refused. He pursued an independent line, as the alternative was to place this country in the degraded position of being held in leading strings by France, which would be unsuitable to the power and station of England. As Charles Webster reflected, everything depended on the energy and determination of Palmerston himself, and that, in the end, all recognised that it was a personal as well as a national triumph. The French retreat and the resolution of the Eastern Question in his favour moved Palmerston to exclaim, "We shall have a capital story to tell about external affairs when Parliament meets," regretting that his colleagues were not as much pleased as they ought to be. Yet, there was scant time to revel in these victories. While he contended with French feelings, British forces were engaging in war both in Afghanistan and China, and negotiations with Washington over disputed boundaries was soon to intensify following the imprisonment of Alexander MacLeod. National Honour's depth of meaning and resonance with the public allowed contemporaries to argue for its defence in policies as dangerous as war with Russia for the liberation of Poland and the forceful repelling of French insults on the high seas, or as mundane as the withdrawal of a British legion fighting in the Spanish Civil War. Britons also experienced the sensation of such sentiments being used against them. Above all, national honour was an unignorable entity, even while contemporaries contested its meaning and relevance. One is struck by the primacy of national honour, repeatedly professed, and the importance of being capable of defending it. Statesmen and newspapers deployed the language of honour and were compelled to frame their decisions according to its tenets. The constraint this placed upon ministerial presentations of policy could only be overcome through substantive public explanation, such as the identification of forbearance. Yet it could also facilitate success, as seen in the use of good faith to excuse the continuation of the technically obsolete Russian-Dutch loan. However, by publicly subsuming their policy decisions in the rhetoric of honour, this arguably added greater urgency to serious incidents and placed greater pressure upon Palmerston. He was held to account and heavily censored when it appeared that the high standards he had lauded were not fulfilled. The rhetoric of honour, indeed, was at its most anxious when insults were received, while the penalty for improperly meeting them was severe, both in terms of political credit and the perceived damage which could be inflicted on the nation. The next chapter will consider how ministers grappled with several insults while assessing whether the concept of the honour script provides a useful measuring stick of the ethics standards and expectations. Members in Parliament and the press which represented them proved tireless in the application and occasional manipulation of national honour's tenets, which could brook no compromise and frequently demanded the highest price for satisfaction. Thus ends the first chapter of my thesis history, friend, and you're hopefully now prepared for what's to come. Having examined ideas like good faith, obligation, and insult, we now get to see how these ideas presented themselves again, and how they were developed by other nations, political opponents, and Palmerston himself into the future. The rhetoric of national honour suffused these ideas, and granted them an additional potency, which lent itself to political pressure campaigns. Palmerston found that there was little wiggle room once such a crisis developed, but he did also learn that the mere act of defiance could reap impressive political rewards. The problem for Palmerston was that these rewards could not prevent the inevitable. While his status as the defender of national honour had been cemented, the Whig government was facing an insurmountable challenge in the reinvigorated Conservative Party, coupled with a country disenchanted from a decade of Whig rule. Palmerston could not work miracles, but he could make adept use of the rhetoric of national honour to preserve his position for the moment and preserve British interests in the Mediterranean and Near East. This proved an important legacy, but another striking fact of the period was also emerging. Britain had its fingers in so many pies, there was always something going on, and these crises could often occur simultaneously to one another. Thus, as he struggled with the implications of Iberian civil war, the disruption of the status quo in the Near East, and a potential war with France, Palmerston was pulled in additional directions too. In the distant realm of China, for instance, Britain faced an enemy of unprecedented size and power, which had committed the cardinal sin of inflicting an insult upon Britain, thus jeopardising her national honour. It was contested whether this insult was sufficiently provocative to necessitate war, just as Britain's ability to beat China was anxiously discussed, but by spring 1839 there could be little doubt that the Opium War was a fact. For the sake of honour, and a great deal of interest, Britain prepared to fight Beijing, and would soon invade Afghanistan for similar reasons. These colonial contests will be examined in the second chapter, so I hope you'll join me for that. Until then, thanks so much for listening and supporting this show, and I hope you enjoyed our exploration of Chapter 1. My name is Zach, this has been my thesis series, and I'll be seeing you all soon.